Good morning. The markets are moving and so are you from the BizNews studios. This is BizNews Daybreak for Wednesday, the 10th of December, 2025. I'm Alec Hogg. Here's the context you need to win the day. Good morning. Here is how Wall Street performed last night, South African time. Well, in a nutshell, the markets hit the pause button. It was a mixed and quiet session as investors refused to make big bets ahead of the Federal Reserve decision later today. The Dow was the lagger, dropping roughly 0.5%. S&P 500 finished virtually flat. The tech-heavy Nasdaq managed to squeeze out a tiny gain of 0.1%. The big story, though, was J.P. Morgan Chase. No, not the departure of Buffett protege Todd Coombs from Berkshire to J.P., but the banking fell. Banking giant fell 5% after executives warned that the current economic environment feels fragile. We'll have more of that coming up in the next little part of the show. But right now, all eyes are on the Fed. Markets have priced in an interest rate cut for tonight, but traders are nervously waiting for Chair Jerome Powell's comments before moving this way or that. Expect volatility to pick up in US markets and probably a very nervous JSE today as well. But a very special, a bonus show for you today, lots in it, but a very special kickoff as we go to the Qantas Departure Lounge at Brisbane Airport, where a member of the BizNews community, Rory Steyn, awaits to tell us about the big news that's rocking Australia and is of importance to any parent, grandparent, or anyone who actually cares about children.
Yeah, well, it's early morning where you are, Alec, but it's already almost 1:30 in the afternoon where I am. And yes, big things indeed. Australia leading the world in having just announced at effective midnight last night, so that's literally just over 13 hours ago, a ban on under 16s accessing social media. So the Australian government has nominated a list of social media companies that include the obvious ones like Instagram, TikTok, WeChat, and a whole bunch of others, and they will add to that list. And they are holding the tech companies responsible. So they're making it the tech companies' problem at the risk of a $50 million fine should they not get it right. And about 350,000 Instagram accounts and over 210,000 TikTok accounts are being deactivated to protect teens. And this, as I watched the media release of this by the Prime Minister and the Communications Minister, I think it was, of the current government, but they were backed up by a whole bunch of NGOs and community organizations. And as the Prime Minister said, this is not led by politicians. This is being led by the people of Australia.
That was securities expert Rory Steyn. He will be talking, ironically, on the protection of our personal liberties at the Neil de Beer Liberty Conference on the 9th of March next year. That's immediately ahead of the BizNews conference. You can get all the details of that on the BizNews website. If you have made plans to come to the BNC 8, as we call it, from the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then play golf on the Friday, why not write in the Monday as well? Star-studded lineup. It'll be opened by Helen Ziller. On to our partners at Bloomberg now with lots of insights into what's happening, the freshest international news.
SpaceX is moving ahead with plans for an IPO, perhaps as soon as mid to late 2026. Now, the company would seek to raise significantly more than $30 billion. We are told SpaceX is targeting a valuation for the entire company of around $1.5 trillion. Now, SpaceX is expecting to use some of these funds to develop space-based data centers, including purchasing the chips required to run them. Here is Bloomberg's Eric Johnson.
Over the years, SpaceX executives have talked about an IPO, and the idea was is that, you know, as they become cash flow positive, they could spin off Starlink as its own IPO. It's more of a consumer tech play, but the plans have changed. And if you look at the growth of SpaceX, yeah. and you look at not just becoming the most prolific rocket launch company on Earth. But now they've got plans for their gigantic Starship.
That is Bloomberg's Eric Johnson. The equity market ended little changed in front of the Fed's final interest rate decision of 2025. Here's Bloomberg's Michael McKee.
Well, the bet on Wall Street is that the Fed chair, Jay Powell, is going to try to suggest that this was the last insurance cut that they're going to take out for a while, that they will probably pause in January to see where the economy is. Of course, they don't have a great idea yet because we're still missing a lot of data. But they're beginning to get to the point where some people think they're at neutral. And if they were to cut any more, they'd be overstimulative. And inflation is certainly not back to their target. So this may be the last one. That's kind of, I think, going to be the message from Mr. Powell.
That is Bloomberg's Michael McKee. Meantime, President Trump will reportedly launch the last round of interviews for Fed chair this week. The FT saying it will pit White House economic advisor Kevin Hassett against a trio of other candidates. Now, Hassett is considered to be the front runner. Today, President Trump was asked to comment on that FT report.
We're going to be looking at a couple of different people, but I have a pretty good idea who I want.
That was President Trump speaking to reporters earlier aboard Air Force One. We are getting more details on President Trump's move to allow NVIDIA to sell its H200 chips to China. We are told the administration felt the move carried a lower security risk because China's Huawei technology already offered AI systems with comparable performance. Here is Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow.
The president was presented with a range of options, from send the absolute latest technology and flood the Chinese market to suffocate Huawei's ability to develop its own tech stack there, right through to do nothing at all, allow no technology to go, even if deprecated. The H200 decision is seen as a kind of best case scenario, because even though it is 18 months behind Blackwell generation at the cutting edge, it is enough where it makes it attractive for Chinese technology companies to use.
That is Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow. Now, the president met privately with NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang before making that decision, and Huang pressed for relief from U.S. export controls. The business software giant Oracle will be reporting earnings after the bell on Wednesday. Day. We have a preview from Bloomberg's Tom Busby.
Oracle's main objective: to prove to anxious investors that there is no potential bubble in AI. That's after partnering with OpenAI earlier this year to provide cloud computing services for artificial intelligence workloads. But investors have grown a little skeptical, and now they've been a little cautious about the massive upfront costs needed to build data centers. So they'll want to hear any new information on new cloud customers. Bloomberg Consensus calls for revenue of $16.21 billion on adjusted earnings per share of $1.64. Tom Busby, Bloomberg Radio.
J.P. Morgan Chase's Marianne Lake says the bank is anticipating spending $105 billion next year, and that is greater than analyst estimates. Her remarks sent shares in J.P. Morgan down by more than 4.5% today. We have more from Bloomberg's Charlie Pellett.
Speaking at a Goldman Sachs conference, Lake said the biggest driver of the expected cost growth is volume and growth-related expenses. She also pointed to strategic investments and the structural consequence of inflation. Shares had their biggest decline in 8 months. The guidance is higher than even the top estimate from analysts surveyed by Bloomberg and surpasses the average outlook for $101.1 billion. In New York, Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
Accenture and Anthropic have announced a major expansion of their partnership. The companies have a multi-year deal to form the Accenture-Anthropic Business Group. Now, the aim is to help enterprises move from AI pilots to full-scale deployment. This will include training for 30,000 Accenture professionals on Anthropic's Claude AI models. Here is Accenture CEO Julie Sweet.
We are really focused on creating sustainable entry-level jobs with AI. And so our pivot in the talent side is, how do we now take our entry-level people, or we call them reinventors, coming in and give them the skills so they can operate at a higher level?
That is Accenture CEO Julie Sweet speaking earlier to Bloomberg.
Well, here in South Africa, the big news yesterday came late in the day. A IMF mission led by Delia Vlahovic spent the first week of December assessing the economy. The resulting Article 4 document was released yesterday. It's like a report card for a student who's finally started doing some homework, but looks like failing the final exam because of years of bunking classes. First, the good news. The IMF has officially recognized that we on the ground understand only too well the South African economy is a lot more resilient than people give it credit for. Despite the issues that we're seeing locally and the global environment defined by protectionism, tariffs, geopolitical messiness, we've held the line here, thankfully, and that's largely due, the IMF suggests, to the adults in the room at the South African Reserve Bank, SARS, and the National Treasury. It credits the successful exit from the grey list and a shift to a lower credible inflation target of 3% as massive wins for the country, something we at BizNews have been saying as well. Also, the moves have already calmed financial markets and contributed to a credit rating upgrade. However, the IMF projects growth for the economy at just 1.3% this year and 1.4% next year. That's no good when you're growing your population at 1.6%. Reason? Labor market rigidity. It's still far too hard to hire and fire. Logistics bottlenecks. Transnet, a massive headache. And governance weaknesses. The IMF was blunt. It said that the current state-led development model, something that Cyril Ramaphosa and the ANC just are so obsessed with, despite all of the evidence, it says this has hit a wall. It cannot address South Africa's poverty or unemployment. The state has run out of money and its balance sheet is maxed out. It also says that Minister Gorondwana is actually taking a chance when he says that the primary surplus of 1.5% of GDP by the next fiscal year will be enough to start reducing the debt in the country. The IMF says the numbers just don't add up. The requirement is a primary surplus of 3% or more, and that means a primary surplus is where the revenue against expenditure, excluding interest payments. I did ask the Treasury guys about this and quiz them a little at the lockup, the budget lockup this year, but they were quite determined and explained to me, well, you know, that there are reasons and it's complex and everything else, but it's nice to see that the IMF says, what you are talking about is not going to stop the debt from continuing to spiral. And they're basically saying, unless our sugar-addicted political elite takes some bitter medicine, we are going to get into a debt trap. And that bitter medicine is slash the wage bill. The IMF wants performance-linked pay and a rationalized, in other words, reduced-sized public service. No more a dumping ground for friends of friends who are loyal cadres. Fixed procurement. The new Procurement Act needs teeth to stop what it calls leakage. It's just a polite word for what we know as corruption. And hardball on the SOE. Stop throwing good money after bad. Transfers to state-owned enterprises must be linked to actual operational performance. It says that if there were a pivot to the private sector, unlocking the private sector in South Africa is the only viable option, and doing so could actually boost real output in this country substantially. Good news all around from the IMF. Let's hope Pretoria's finally listening. On the corporate front, well, there was some last-minute reprieve for South Africa's embattled ferrochrome sector yesterday. This following high-stakes engagements right down to the wire between Glencore, Eskom and the trade union NUMSA. NUMSA members marched on the union buildings to protest energy tariffs. A little while later, the local CEO, Yapi Fulard, contacted the union leadership to confirm that a memorandum of understanding had been signed between Glencore / Marafi and Eskom. According to the message that NUMSA sent out to its members, Glencore has agreed to suspend the broader retrenchment process and halt voluntary severance packages that were due to be processed this week. Marafi Resources confirmed this on SENS, the Stock Exchange News Service, stating that the consultation process has now been extended until the end of February so that Eskom, Glencore, Marafi can find a workable energy solution. Basically, what that means is cutting the electricity costs so that those ferrochrome smelters can keep working. Thousands of jobs are involved and, well, hundreds of millions in exports. It's good news coming out of Thungela Resources, the coal company. It just keeps going better and better. The share price yesterday was up 3.5% after a pre-close update was released, showing that the South African operations will deliver 13.7 million tons of export coal for this year, ahead of the previous ceiling of 13.6 million tons. This was due to a successful ramp-up at the new Annea colliery, and better than expected, would you believe, rail performance from Transnet. So although the IMF thinks Transnet's still a big problem, there are some green shoots there. It wasn't all smooth sailing for Thungela, though. Its Australian mine, Ensham, faced what they call geological challenges, but aggressive marketing in Dubai secured sales for that low-quality coal, keeping production within guidance. The market loved the story, as mentioned before. The shares were up 3.5% yesterday. And finally, on the corporate front, end of an era for a South African media giant, MultiChoice delisted from the JSE yesterday. You won't find any more reference to MultiChoice in future by the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. This follows the squeeze out by the French broadcaster Canal Plus, which bought the company, the South African company, which was independent but previously a subsidiary of NASPAS. It isn't a permanent goodbye, though, because MultiChoice, although it leaves the board this week, we'll have Canal Plus coming back as a secondary listed company on the JSE within the next 9 months. That means it'll be here ready to trade, ready for South Africans to trade by, before the end of 2026. Well, let's move on to the first of those two international stories. Now, Famous Brands this morning announced that it is going into Malaysia. This is the company that famously took a big knock when it invested in the UK through the acquisition of Gourmet Burger Kitchens. I caught up today with Man on the Run, Group Executive Terry Boardman.
We are obviously going in with Steers and Devonair Pizza into the Malaysian market with a great partner in Mesra. They've got lots of experience with retail, and obviously they link to the Petronas Group. So got lots of real estate kind of across the Malaysian landscape. So really a good partner to kind of get into Malaysia with, and we're very excited about it from that point of view.
And I guess the South African connection would have helped a little, given that Petronas is represented here through Engen.
Well, they were. They've sold out their share in Engen. But that's how we kind of linked up with them in terms of the relationship. It was towards the end of their kind of tenure here with Engen, so they're no longer involved there. But that's kind of how the introduction happened, and it's kind of flowed from there. Yeah, great opportunity in the Malaysian market. Just to kind of get in with somebody that's really kind of got the experience, done a very great job of kind of growing retail, especially with their Mesra cafes across the Petronas fuel sites across Malaysia. So very exciting.
Is it going to be at the garage, at the petrol stations, as we call them here in South Africa?
Yes, we've got our first locations opened in Bangi, which is a suburb just outside Kuala Lumpur. And that is in a petroleum site, but separately to the C store. So it's a Debonair's Pizza and a Steers combo that we've initiated there. But there are other opportunities. There's several other opportunities that sit outside of the petroleum network. So obviously the petroleum network is a kind of easy in terms of expansion with the Mesra Group. that there's opportunities sitting outside of that as they expand into other retail environments. It's important to choose the right partner when you're going into these markets. I mean, Malaysia is, as we well know, quite an established market in a growth phase, and very similar in terms of the, I suppose, the family unit and the dynamics that we've seen if we compare it to the South African market. So it didn't feel unfamiliar in terms of how we would enter the market with Mesra as a partner and how we would ultimately grow. I suppose the word to say is grow confidently but cautiously in the market rather than going with a big bang. We've got a very clear plan in terms of how we're going to approach that particular market. So it's not about rolling out hundreds of stores within a short space of time. It's about consciously going after those sites and locations that make sense. And we're quite differentiated in the market compared to the international players. So there's a nice opportunity for us to bring something different to the Malaysian market.
Famous Brands has clearly learned its lesson from the Gourmet Burger King acquisition that went wrong and is doing things differently now. A similar opportunistic decision cost Spar very dearly. They're not looking to do any more international activities for the moment after taking a 4.8 billion rand knock on getting out of Switzerland and Poland, where it had invested opportunistically a while back. I spoke to the chief executive of Spar, Angelo Swartz, about what this meant for the company for the financial year to the end of September.
But yeah, a difficult year for Spar. We've had to make some really difficult and strong decisions. The exit of the European businesses meant that we recognized some write-downs in the goodwill of those assets and the value of those assets so that we could exit them quickly, which we've now done and is behind us. Thankfully, those impairments are largely non-cash. And so we were able to recognize those impairments while reducing our debt and keeping the continuing operations going fairly nicely.
Yeah, that's the good news part of these results is the debt falling very sharply. Has that been part of your intention from the day you took over?
Yeah, so I think the day this management team took over, we kind of articulated five key short-term priorities. And those being, one was the reduction of the debt, the other was the exiting of Poland, and the third key one was figuring out how our European portfolio fitted into the long-term picture for the group. I think we've signed off on all three of those now. And then a key part of that was in ensuring that the business was at a sustainable level of debt for South African business. The levels of gearing or the appetite for gearing in Europe is a lot higher for the appetite for gearing in South Africa. Obviously, a lot of that related to what the interest rate in the across the geographies look like. But yeah, the reduction of debt is a big, big part of our story and was a big driver for some of our decisions. Yeah.
That full interview in what we call the director's cut is on biznews.com/briefing. And closing off, the Bank for International Settlements has taken the most unusual approach of warning that the gold market and the US equity market are heading for bubbles driven by people like you and I, retail investors. The Financial Times' resources editor, Leslie Hook, has got the story for us.
The BIS is the bank to the central banks. So it's usually quite a conservative institution. It's handling central banks' assets and advising them on their investments. And so it's quite unusual to hear it come out with such a strong statement that gold and U.S. equities might be entering bubble territory. And one reason why it says this is that prices have risen a lot this year. Gold is up 60%, the S&P 500 is up 17%, and NASDAQ is up 22% this year. And the second characteristic that the BIS picked up on in its report is that both these asset classes have been marked by a retail frenzy. We've seen retail investors pour into the gold market, particularly in the last 3 months or so. Earlier in the year, we saw more central bank buying, more institutional investors, and this retail interest has kind of, you know, supercharged gold prices from about September onwards. Now, the BIS sees this retail involvement as being potentially risky for the market. And its report says, quote unquote, that retail investors have a propensity to engage in herd-like behavior, amplifying price gyrations should fire sales occur. So it's identifying this retail involvement as one indication that we could be in a bubble.
How significant is it that both equities and gold are forming bubbles at the same time?
Well, it's quite unusual. The BIS points out that this is the first time in 50 years that both these asset classes have exhibited this type of behavior at the same time. Typically, gold is seen as a safe haven asset. So when you're in a high-risk environment, you might sell your equities and buy gold. But that's not what's been happening this year.
And now you have the edge. For the full interviews and the details behind these stories, head over to biznews.com. I'm Alec Hogg. Thank you for starting your morning with us. Now go and seize the day.